Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Most of us think in broad brushstrokes of iconic images, the sit-ins, the brutality of the police with their German Shepherd attack dogs and water hoses, the marches, the demonstrations, the speeches, and above all else, Martin Luther King Jr., the man who is honored today with a national holiday. But the civil rights movement is not only more than a sum of those parts. It has played out in important ways across the South in places perhaps you've never heard of, often far from the star power, and in the North as well. Joining us today are three eminent historians to talk about those stories and how the movement has fared since the March on Washington in 1963. Lauren Areza, she's an assistant professor of history at Denison University. Her current research focuses on the connections between the civil rights movement and the Chicano movement. She is completing a book entitled For Freedom of Other Men, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the United Farm Workers. Welcome to the show, Lauren.
Thank you.
Also, Emily Crosby, she's an associate professor of history at the State University of New York in Geneseo. Emily is the author of A Little Taste of Freedom, The Black Freedom Struggle in Claiborne County, Mississippi. Her interests are African-American and women's history, especially the civil rights movement and other movements for social justice. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Thank you.
And Hassan Kwame Jeffries is an Ohio State University Associate Professor of African-American History. Hassan holds a joint appointment with the Kerwin Institute and the Department of History. Dr. Jeffries specializes in 20th century African-American history with an expertise in the civil rights power movement. He's the author of a book about the African-American freedom struggle in Lowndes County, Alabama, the 1966 birthplace of the Black Panther Party. Welcome to the show, Hassan.
Great to be here.
Emily, why don't we kick off with you? What can you just kind of give us a sense about the difference between how the civil rights movement is popularly perceived and how it has really played out in the United States?
Okay, I'll try to get started on that. Well, I think that the major perception, certainly my students, when they come to class and people that I meet, their perception of the movement is very much dominated by the images you talked about. Martin Luther King, especially giving his I Have a Dream speech, sort of frozen in time in 1963, and sort of this image of even starting with Rosa Parks as an elderly kind of passive person who just somehow happened to start the civil rights movement that King then led and took care of. And so there's a focus on a handful of people, some dramatic events, and there's also a perception that it was entirely successful and that racism was handled by the passage of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act of 1964 and 65. And I think if we look at the movement, we see that it's a much longer struggle, that it involves so many more people, that lots of the key issues, many of the tactics tend to be invisible. So, for example, there's a real focus on desegregation and voting rights, both of which were important, but you get missing from that some of the other sort of human rights issues that were fundamental to people in the movement. I could continue, but my colleagues might want to...
Well, I was going to say, Hassan, Emily brought up the just happened to. There wasn't much that happened in the civil rights movement that has just happened to happen.
Right. I mean, one of the things that's often overlooked is the long and hard process of organizing. We get so caught up with the grand events, the spectacle events, mass mobilizing events like the March on Washington, for example, that we fail to look behind the scenes. We fail to look at what people were doing on the ground over time. Now, part of that is not just a contemporary problem. It's also something that was reflective of how civil rights organizing was covered at the moment, where the press would zero in on the speech makers, on the big events. It was easier to cover. It was easier to say that Martin Luther King was the movement, to focus in on one person, Rosa Parks, during the Montgomery bus boycott, than it was to zero in on the ordinary people, on the women who made the bus boycott happen, on the local organizers who are canvassing, going door to door in rural places throughout the South. That's much harder to capture and convey. And so the problem that we have today as historians and as scholars is wrestling with sort of the misconceptions, a misunderstanding of how the movement itself was made. In addition to sort of goals and obstacles and tactics and opponents, just the very construction, the fabric of the movement is often misunderstood and reduced to just a handful of people.
Well, that's true of history in general, though. Isn't that what historians are all about? But was there any particular challenges to getting at that fabric of this movement?
Challenges that we face as
sort of, historians, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, part of it, I mean, one, you're dealing with, and my colleagues can speak to this as well, I mean, this idea of sort of the public understanding. So on the first hand, you have to unravel everything that's been sort of learned. But then there's the very process of getting to the base. And how do you do that? How do you capture or how do you recover sort of stories that have been marginalized, people who have been marginalized? And there's a number of ways to do it. Obviously, as historians, we're sort of trained in sort of the traditional ways that you uncover history. You go to archives, you look at newspapers and the like. But I think critical to this particular period, and all of us have done this, is oral histories and talking to people who have never been talked to before, getting their accounts of sort of movement activism, what happened, their perspective. Because once you do that, you really begin to put flesh on bones. You really begin to fill out the story. The more voices you add to a sort of movement history, the more complex and the fuller the story as a whole becomes.
And the voices, Emily, they're, you know, time's a wasting.
Yeah, we. I think we have all done oral history. Well, as Hassan said, we've all done oral histories. I began doing some in the early 90s, and even then, there were people that I would have loved to talk to who had already passed on, but were, you know, I think in a race against time to capture as many stories and perspectives and voices as we can. One of the things I wanted to follow up on that Hassan just mentioned in terms of your question of how do we get at this part of the story. I think most people know Eyes on the Prize, the well-known documentary series that came out, the first part in the 1980s. And then the second part in the early 90s has a very short clip, very short segment on the Lowndes County movement that Hassan writes about. And they almost weren't able to do that story because their choices were dictated by what there was film coverage of at the time. And so they had to have film coverage in order to show that story. And they were able to do it. But then, you know, however many years later, Hassan has published his book on Lowndes County that isn't as dependent on that film coverage, that moment in the public eye, but draws really heavily on these oral histories. And so I think that that's a tangible example of the challenges of doing this kind of history and the different ways people have framed it.
It's called Bloody Lowndes, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. Hassan, how did you find this story? What inspired you to follow this story?
Well, it's interesting that Emily should mention Eyes on the Prize because when it was first broadcast and I was a kid in high school in New York City and my parents literally said, you're going to sit down and watch this. I remember seeing that very segment on Lowndes County and Stokely Carmichael and SNCC organizers working and organizing in Alabama. And that stayed with me. And so all throughout college and even in graduate school, particularly in graduate school, when I began to think about, well, what do I want to do? What do I want to write about? That story was in the back of my mind. And so that led me to sort of dig a little deeper. And so the book came out of literally watching, being exposed to a different kind of public history that was Eyes on the Prize. But in order to make it happen, in order to make the book possible, I had to go into the county and interview people who had never been interviewed before, people who were involved in the movement, whose names were left off of the public record. And that's the only way the book was possible, was to recapture those lost histories that were being housed or held by people who, even since I have done interviews, have since passed on.
There aren't, even in the book, there aren't a lot of photographs, but they're more than I actually expected.
I mean, the other thing is we often think about, well, what's recorded and what's not recorded, what's lost. But when we begin to dig a little deep and peel back the layers, there's actually more coverage in places we don't necessarily expect to find of these various movements. And the movement that I cover, this local movement in Lowndes County, Alabama, although it's sort of been pushed to the sides, was so central. I mean, it wasn't something that was just a side story. I mean, this was the nexus between the civil rights and Black Power movements. It's where the original Black Panther Party comes from, where the Black Panther symbol comes from. It's where Stokely Carmichael really formulates, along with SNCC organizers, the idea for Black Power. And so although it's one of those stories that will not be talked about that much today on Martin Luther King Day as we reflect back on the civil rights movement, those who were active in the movement understood then as well as now that it was one of those critical central stories to the development of the movement as a whole.
And from reading the book, what I got out of it immediately was that the Black Power wasn't about violence.
Oh, absolutely.
It was about power.
Oh, absolutely. But it's funny because it becomes so mythologized almost from the start that when we begin to look at what it was about power. But it was but the problem was power was understood in a particular context at that moment in time, mm-hmm. that power stemmed from violence. And so the association of the acquisition of power, democratic power, small d democratic power, race, black, was automatically associated with violence. And so from the very start, although this wasn't a thing about violence, it wasn't anything that was anti-white. It was something that was fundamentally American when you look at it, although it was going against basic American traditions of exclusion with regard to politics and democracy, that what was at its core something that was so American becomes lost in the shuffle.
We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll finish our conversation with our historians, Hassan Kwame Jeffries from Ohio State University, Emily Crosby from SUNY in Geneseo, and also Lauren Areza from Denison University. So if you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. When we return, talk with Lauren more about how the movement affected other movements around the country. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. At 1 o'clock this afternoon, On Point discusses a push to ban high-capacity clips like those used by the Arizona shooter. That discussion on Point at 1 o'clock, right here on 89.7. 24 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today and a high of 34 degrees. A chance of rain tonight, possibly freezing rain as well, a low right around 32. Rain showers throughout the day on Tuesday, a high of 40 degrees. And then Tuesday night, look for a wintry mix of rain mixing with a little snow overnight, a low of 26 degrees. A slight chance of snow Wednesday morning and then clouds in the afternoon and a high of 30. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And Hassan, that the words from a verse from that song is how you kick off your book.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Oh, and Oh Freedom. You know, when I began to think about what African Americans were fighting for during the Civil Rights Movement, what we call the Civil Rights Movement, and Emily spoke to this briefly in her opening comments, and she mentioned what were the goals. And as I began to do the research in Lowndes County and elsewhere, I began to realize that African Americans weren't fighting simply for civil rights. They were also fighting for human rights. So what we're calling a civil rights movement is actually a misnomer. Yes, they were fighting for those basic rights that are enumerated in the federal constitution, U.S. Constitution, and state constitutions, but they were also fighting for fundamental and basic human rights, those God-given rights that everyone is born with and entitled to with regard to education and decent housing, protection, and the like. And so I began to walk back in time, and I realized that what African Americans were fighting for in the 1960s were the same things that they were fighting for in the 1860s. At the moment of emancipation, African Americans begin to reflect and look back on those rights that had been denied them as enslaved persons, and they begin to pursue those. So what African Americans are fighting for in 1865 are what I call freedom rights. They're fighting for how they envisioned what freedom would be in a post-emancipation world. And they're continuing to fight for those 100 years later because they have been denied. And so this spiritual, oh, freedom, before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave, spoke to me spoke about this idea of what freedom was. And that's what African Americans were fighting for. Freedom, not just in an abstract way, but freedom in a very concrete way based upon their experiences in America dating back to slavery.
Lauren Areza, is that thought process something that resonates with other groups out there that are working on improving their lot in life in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. As the movement really started to take off and get a lot of publicity, other groups around the country, you know, of course, with the tremendous media attention, looked to the movement and saw parallels, recognized similarities with their own lives. And what African Americans in the South were dealing with was remarkably similar to what Mexican American farm workers in California were dealing with. They dealt with brutality from law enforcement. They dealt with being exploited as workers, being disenfranchised. So they then looked to the movement, okay, what? They looked to the movement as inspiration. What can we do? What tactics can we take and apply to our situation? Because they are so similar, even if there are geographical differences and ethnic differences. So, excuse me, Hassan mentioned before the break, Black Power. Black Power really especially resonated. And again, as he pointed out, Black Power is incredibly misunderstood. I teach an intellectual history of Black Power, and I feel like much of what I do is undoing what people think Black Power is. But really, the parts of Black Power that were so appealing to other groups, Mexican-Americans, Native Americans, Asian Americans, was self-determination. The idea of changing your life, changing your circumstances through your own power, not relying on anyone else to improve your life for you. And then also the economic parts of Black Power, the political parts of Black Power, using your strength as a group to achieve change and doing it from the ground up, not relying on political leaders to make those changes for you. And that was incredibly, I can't really think of a better word than empowering, for a variety of Americans.
Can you give us some examples of how that was used, how it was employed? I guess the United Farm Workers was formed in that spirit.
Sure. Their formation actually was in 1962 by Cesar Chavez. This is the subject of my own research. But one of the things that really moved them was not the March on Washington, but was the Selma to Montgomery March in 1965. And so in 1966, the farm workers were on strike against grape growers in Delano, California. And they were trying to draw attention to a boycott that they had begun against Shedley Industries, a liquor company. So they're trying to think of a way to dramatize what they're doing, to get national attention, because the national media was not paying attention to this group of farm workers in California Central Valley. So they looked to the Selma to Montgomery March, and they said, we should do that. And so they do a march from Delano to Sacramento, California, that succeeds not only in getting a contract, the first ever contract for farm workers, first ever union contract, that is, it ends the boycott of Shenley Industry, but it also gets national attention for the United Farm Workers, for Cesar Chavez, and really catapults that movement to the forefront of Americans' consciousness. And it's the example of the Selma to Montgomery March that does that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are Lauren Areza. She's an assistant professor of history at Denison University, Emily Crosby, she's an associate professor of history at the State University of New York in Geneseo, and also Hassan Kwame Jeffries, he's an Ohio State University associate professor of African American history. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Carol from Springfield, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Carol.
My husband was city manager of a city near Columbus in the 60s, and there was a fair housing ordinance that was being debated. And my children were 4 and 2 at the time, and a man called who was against the fair housing ordinance and threatened the children. He said he could see them playing in the yard, and he was a very good marksman, and my husband should oppose the fair housing ordinance. I decided it was so bad that I would put them in a wagon and carry information about the fair housing ordinance and pass it out, because that was just so wrong.
Dr. Crosby, Emily, you've written about the northern or the bigger cities, Milwaukee, the more urban northern centers where there were issues like this going on that aren't necessarily told in much thoroughness.
Actually, I haven't spent a lot of time on that, but I certainly teach it. And one of the things, though, that immediately strikes me about Carol's story, which there are a couple of things. One, that kind of threatening and attempts at intimidation, I think, was pervasive certainly throughout the Southern movement, and I think people know that. I think people are less aware of the extent to which there was violence throughout the North, including Detroit, Milwaukee, some of these big urban centers, to enforce housing segregation. And so there's a notion that housing segregation somehow just happens, or it's natural, or it's people's choices, when in fact housing segregation is reinforced by policy, federal and state and local policy. It's reinforced by lending practices. It's reinforced by violence and these attempts at intimidation. Another thing that you see that Carol's experience also speaks to is that sometimes these attempts to intimidate people backfire. And you see this throughout the civil rights movement, where people, Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi in Sunflower County was a sharecropper and a timekeeper in her early 40s. And when she went down, when she goes down and tries to register to vote for the first time in her life as an adult woman, when she gets back to the plantation where she and her husband have lived for over 2 decades, she's met by the plantation owner, who says that if she doesn't take her name off that list, she has to leave the plantation. Well, she says to him, "I didn't go try to register for you. I did it for myself." And she leaves herself that night. She's shot at subsequently and beaten and so on. And she becomes a really important activist. And certainly there are people who were intimidated by violence, but there are many other people who said, "You know, I'm not going to let that stop me. I'm going to stand for what's right," in the way that Carol did.
Carol, thanks for the call, and thanks for your story.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment for our panel of historians. Lowndes County differed in some ways from other local developments, other local organizing efforts, in that outsiders played such a vital role in it. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we have to understand when we think about the African-American freedom struggle and the civil rights movement is that there was a dynamic relationship between local people and outside organizers. Southern segregationists called them outside agitators. But these were people who were associated with the national movement organizations, SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, King's Organization. But I write specifically about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. This was a, as they like to say, a band of brothers and sisters in a circle of trust. These were young people who had dedicated their lives to fighting for freedom and justice in America, primarily in the South, but really in America. And so what we see in places like Lowndes County is in 1965, a county that's 80% African-American, located between Selma and Montgomery, 80% African-American, not a single African-American was registered to vote. In other words, political exclusion was absolute 1 year after the Voting Rights Act was passed. And SNCC organizers purposefully choose to go into this county that was known, called Bloody Lowndes, because of the violence. And this just wasn't sort of phone calls as Carol experienced and the threats. This was people who had lived a life where whites had acted on violence, where lynchings and murders occurred in real time over the course of generations. And they said, we're going to go down there and work with the people on the ground to make democracy real. And what they do is phenomenal. I mean, they not only help register a majority of African Americans over the course of the next year and a half, but they create their own independent, help them create their own independent political party. And so we, and this just wasn't sort of outside organizers, Stokely Carmichael or Martin Luther King, descending on a place, bringing the light of freedom to local people who never understood what freedom was. They weren't, as I say, movement messiahs, mm-hmm. but they were people who had experience in organizing, who had a certain expertise, and they brought that to bear in these local places. But these movements simply would not have occurred. These local movements that are scattered throughout the country and throughout the South, they would not have occurred if you had not people on the ground, ordinary people, willing to make extraordinary sacrifices in the face of economic intimidation, in the face of death. And so it's that symbiotic relationship of bringing in an expertise from outside, but then also a courage and a commitment that is just hard to understand and hard to believe and hard to fathom in the face of the obstacles that people face, that local people brought to the table. And it's the nexus, that joining of the two that really is so phenomenal, that was the engine behind all the change that we saw during the 50s, 60s, 70s, and after.
Now, the clergy weren't very involved in this.
Yeah,
why is that?
One of the myths of the movement, of the freedom struggle, and there are several, and we should begin to sort of peel these back, and Emily does a great job dealing with that. But one of the myths is that this was a minister-led movement. Mm-hmm. And part of that has to do with sort of Dr. King and following Dr. King, and he's such a figure that's so much larger than life. But place is so important to studying any movement and studying the civil rights movement. And one of the things that we have to think about is where these movements occurred. And in Lowndes County and throughout so much of Mississippi and Alabama and South Carolina, these movements occurred in rural places. And in rural places, you did not have these big mega churches, certainly not mega churches like you did today, but you didn't have an Ebenezer Baptist Church. You had churches that met once every 2 weeks that were not as integral to the community in terms of minister-led churches, integral to the community as they were elsewhere. And so ministers simply were not present in the same way that we understand them to be present in big churches that are meeting every Sunday in urban spaces. And so it wasn't that the church wasn't important, because the social networks that were in embedded in churches were critical to mobilizing people and organizing people. It's just that the ministers weren't there. And so we have to turn the camera a little bit away from the pulpit and toward the pews if we want to understand how these movements were made and happened.
As far as outsiders' perception of what was happening then when the ministers weren't involved, because when you had someone like Martin Luther King Jr. involved, there was sort of this aura of, well, he's a minister. You know, he's a man of God. He's a man of the cloth. Lacking that, did that affect the outside perceptions of what was going on in Lowndes County?
It affected not only the outside perceptions of what was happening in Lowndes County, but I think about the movement as a whole. And I would actually defer to Emily on this, because that speaks to a sort of nonviolence and the persona of nonviolence and the importance of nonviolence. And so, Emily, would you like to say a word or two on that?
Sure. I mean, I think that one of the real myths of the civil rights movement, and it's very closely connected to the emphasis on King as the leader, as embodying the movement, and also the focus on the sit-ins and the freedom rides and some of the mass demonstrations that were particularly visible, is that it was an entirely nonviolent movement, that nonviolence was both a tactic and a philosophy, and that it was almost the most important thing about the movement, maybe the most important thing about the movement. And I think that in part, as I said, I think that perception has to do with the focus on these, a kind of top-down focus. And so it becomes a focus on King and ministers who were generally more committed to nonviolence than other people. It becomes a focus on big events, some of the ones I've mentioned, where nonviolence was more visible. People who are working on desegregation, if you move into a lunch counter for a sit-in, most of them made a commitment to respond nonviolently. People doing voter registration work in Lowndes County or Claiborne County, Mississippi, or any of these other small communities, rural communities in the South, nonviolence was not so essential. And not only was nonviolence not essential, but as Hassan mentioned earlier, a lot of times this civil rights activism or even attempts by people individually before the movement begins to register to vote, even to do canvassing to begin meeting, was often met by attempts at economic intimidation and violence. And when whites would, you know, drive by and shoot at African-American homes or bomb African-American homes, often almost in every instance, African-Americans were armed and responded. And so what you get is a public perception or a focus on these big public events around nonviolence, when the less visible part of the movement, African-Americans don't initiate violence. That's a real myth associated with Black Power. But they certainly don't sit back passively and respond nonviolently when they're attacked, especially in their homes, but also in churches and mass meetings. And in part, this self-defense, this protection, was just absolutely fundamentally necessary to the movement and its survival, because there was no viable law enforcement. There was no mechanism for protecting African Americans other than protecting themselves.
And the news media wasn't there filming.
And the news media was not there filming. You know, again, that's part of the news media is more likely to be at a public demonstration, right, than at Mr. Turnbow's home in the middle of the night in rural Holmes County, Mississippi. And so, yeah, it's a lot less visible, those kinds of attacks on people in their homes.
It was an incredibly rural area in Lowndes County. Even still, I think there were a total of maybe 5,000 eligible voters. Or voting people who were eligible to vote. But it was still amazing that it was just 2 years later, 3,000 in 65, I think, was it, that there were zero registered to vote, and just 2 years later, about 3,000 people.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just the story was so amazing. I mean, it's one thing. It's a remarkable accomplishment to register that many in the context of the times.
Yeah.
I mean, in this crucible, this violent crucible of white supremacy. And a part of that is made possible by the passage of the Voting Rights Act. But it was still dangerous to register, even though you had these federal registrars. But what's so remarkable is, and SNCC organizers sort of stated it very plainly. They said, well, what good is it? What will it profit a man to have the vote and not be able to control it? And so the next step, and this bleeds over from sort of civil rights to Black Power era, and what Lauren was talking about in terms of self-determination and empowerment, mm-hmm. was what are we going to do with the vote once we have it in hand? Are we going to vote for Democrats? Are we going to vote for Republicans? Are we going to vote for the party that turned away Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi? Are we going to vote for the party of white supremacy? And that was literally the slogan of the state Democratic Party of Alabama, white supremacy for the right, the party of George Wallace. And they said, no, that's just wasting our votes. So it wasn't just voter registration. It was, what are we going to do with the vote once we have it in hand? And they determined to create their own political party to gain control of the county courthouse to make the decisions that affected their lives. And that's part of the story of the civil rights movement that we often don't get. It wasn't just getting laws on the books, laws passed. It was giving meaning to these various laws so that African Americans would have the tools necessary to make those very basic and fundamental decisions that impacted their very lives.
We have to take another break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Lauren Areza, Assistant Professor of History at Denison University, Emily Crosby, Associate Professor of History at the State University of New York in Geneseo, and also Hassan Kwame Jeffries at Ohio State University, where he's an Associate Professor of African American History. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear the questions you wish you could have asked to people like Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
The most interesting people in show business on Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. On today's edition of the program, Martin Luther King's most famous speech was his I Have a Dream speech. On the next Fresh Air, a discussion with Clarence Jones, who helped draft the speech. But Jones says it was almost entirely spontaneous, except for the first 9 paragraphs. That discussion on Fresh Air beginning at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Star Trek, Lost in Space, and The Twilight Zone are some of the best-loved futuristic television shows of their time. Tuesday night on WOSU-TV, Pioneers of Television explores how the shows used the future as a stage for modern morality plays. William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and other science fiction stars describe how they prepare to interact on camera with an evil alien force, or perhaps a giant radish. Watch Pioneers of Television Tuesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Marburn Academy, a forward-thinking school for ADHD and dyslexic students, inviting you to an admission open house Sunday afternoon, January 30th from 1 to 4. More at marburnacademy.org.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. If you want to have a question or comment for our panel of historians, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What has happened to the Civil Rights Movement since the March on Washington in 1963? How has it evolved? How has it changed? And why? That's what we're talking about today. So you can give us a call or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Lauren, we were talking earlier about the influence that the larger civil rights movement had on other civil rights movements out there, including the United Farm Workers, Native Americans, and that sort of thing. Did the two movements actually intersect at any point? Civil rights organizers from the African-American, did they help?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, I look at pretty much the spectrum of civil rights organizations. I looked at the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the NAACP, the National Urban League, King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the Black Panther Party, and looked at their relationships with the United Farm Workers. And it varied. I found that the first civil rights organization who really steps in and helps the farm workers in a concrete way is SNCC. And I think it's because of what Hassan was talking about their experience with organizing, about the very slow, hands-on organizing that's also really necessary when you're doing labor organizing, when you're trying to convince a worker whose job is already not very secure to go on strike. And why they need to do that. And so SNCC was really the perfect people to come in and assist. And then they also, because they were dealing with violence from law enforcement, violence from growers, violence from the Teamsters, who are a rival union. So SNCC comes in and teaches courses on nonviolent resistance. And they also, they loan staff for years at a time. They loan they give them cars. They give them two-way radios so that when they're organizing picket lines, they could do it strategically. And then also the Black Panther Party becomes incredibly supportive. Of course, they're not formed till 1966. Mm-hmm. But as the farm workers begin a nationwide boycott of California grapes, which went on for some time, a lot of people, I'm sure, out there participate in that boycott, the Black Panther Party publicized the boycott among the Black community. They offered assistance. They publicized news of what was going on with the farm workers in their own newspaper, which were distributed in urban communities. Took a lot of interest. But conversely, the person who's most associated in the kind of, this goes back to the myth-making we've talked about, especially about King, is even when the farm workers movement was happening, people were referring to Cesar Chavez as the Chicano Martin Luther King and creating an association between the two men because they both studied Gandhi, they both practiced nonviolence, they were both deeply religious, but the two men never met. King sent Chavez 2 telegrams of support, but that was it. Didn't urge his followers to participate in any boycott of grapes or liquor products or anything like that. So this relationship between the two men is something that's become constructed. And in fact, when I told one of my professors in graduate school that the two men had never met, much less worked together, that was kind of a traumatic realization for him, because that myth had held so had taken such a strong hold, and it's taken a strong hold among a lot of people. But really, the farm workers' connections to the movement were so much stronger with people who organized, SNCC being the most notable example, rather than the ones who mobilized, the ones who did the big public events.
I want to talk, Hassan, about that connection between Martin Luther King and the imagery of Martin Luther King Jr. You write about that in terms of particularly about political cartoonists and their penchant for reflecting on aspects of Barack Obama in terms of Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, you know, Emily has a book coming out that sort of looks at the civil rights movement from the bottom up. And this is a piece that Emily said, Hassan, you need to write this piece for me about sort of where we are in part today as a society. And I use the occasion of Barack Obama's campaign, his run for office, historic run for the presidency, to sort of look to pause and see where as a nation the movement is in the minds of people. And I use political cartoons and looking at political cartoons as they were written over the course of a year or so during the campaign and up to and through his election to see how the movement was remembered. And a number of things jumped out. One, the central figure or the movement is remembered through the eyes of Martin Luther King. And it's not just a complex, complicated Martin Luther King. It's Martin Luther King frozen on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, calling for his dream of a colorblind society. And that's one aspect of it. But then there are so many other elements of sort of mythologizing the movement. For example, the opposition to the movement is reduced solely to a handful of sort of Southern hayseeds, these crazy whites now who were crazy segregationists at the time, George Wallace, for example. And I say, well, George Wallace was the governor of the state of Alabama. Ross Barnett was the governor of the state of
educated
Mississippi.
Men.
Educated men who had the full support of their state populations and conservatives across the country. And so that's a myth as well. This was something, opposition to the movement, white supremacy as a whole, was something that was embraced not just by Southerners, but by the nation as a whole. And so there are a number of things that come out in these political cartoons that reflect both on the past, the movement, what it was, what the goals were, what the opposition was, but then also where we stand today. And so lastly, one of the things that sort of came out, and this is why it's so important to get the civil rights movement correct, to understand the African-American freedom struggle, what African-Americans were fighting for and what they were fighting against. Because if we get the past wrong, then we don't understand the present. And so one of the things that comes across so glaringly in these political cartoons is that, well, the real conflict of the past was an emotional one. It was African-Americans who were still upset about segregation, and it was whites who were kind of upset about affirmative action, whites who were kind of upset about being accused of being anti-black. And so that's just an emotional issue. And if we could all just kind of get over our emotional hang-ups of the past generation, then we can move forward as a nation today. The problem with that is that white supremacy wasn't simply a function of personal prejudice. One, it was also deeply embedded in terms of the structures and the fabric of American society. And so we can't just dismiss it as an emotional issue. We have to look at the root causes of it. And once we do that, then we can really begin to address address the issues that we are confronted with today in terms of wealth inequality, in terms of mass incarceration and all, and educational inequality. That's not emotional problems or emotional issues. Those are deeply rooted fundamental society issues.
And wherever they were successful, especially in more isolated cases, in unraveling that fabric, it's incredibly important to know and understand why they succeeded.
Exactly. Because there are valuable lessons in the movement as a whole. And it's not a matter of going back and replicating what people did in the past, but it's going back and pulling out those things that can be useful to us today. And so it's not trying to recreate an independent political party like they did in Lowndes County, but it's saying, what are the democratic principles that they use to organize people around? And they use workshops, for example, in political education. So it wasn't just getting people to come out to vote on election day, but teaching them what the duties of elected officials are so that they could hold them accountable after election day. And those are some of the lessons that are still applicable and can be used today.
Tim from, I guess, the OSU campus, welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. Pleasant, interesting discussion. My remarks are mostly for Professor Jeffries. I've been trying to do some research, but somewhat unsuccessfully. In the 1890s, a Methodist church in Connecticut sent young white women to Lowndes County to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic. And much to my amazement, my grandmother and her older sister were there in 1895 and 1896. And they were in a little town called Calhoun, south of Montgomery. And the white population was very upset, so they had to live with the African Americans, you know, no plumbing. This is a long time ago, and it was a pretty rough going, but evidently there were idealistic educators from Connecticut, and I think it was called the Red Brick Schoolhouse Movement, but it was sponsored by the Methodist Church, and my grandfather eventually picked her up down there, and they got married in Mobile in 96. And she went to live on a farm in Michigan. But I'm trying to get more information about it, and I think she has a diary. Because the civil rights movement does go back, as you stated earlier, all the way to 1865. And do you have any information on kind of missionary school teachers in Lowndes County?
Yeah, and specifically, the specific school that he's talking about is the Calhoun Colored School that, as you mentioned, is formed in the early 1890s. And it's a connection to Booker T. Washington. It's an interesting story because and it speaks to what the sort of goals and tactics of the civil rights movement are. And again, it's not just the vote or dealing with unequal things. But here, the public schools in Lowndes County and so many other places were so bad that African-Americans had a yearning for education and quality education. And so after a series of mass murders in Lowndes County, the people of the county write to Booker T. Washington, the president of Tuskegee Institute at the time, and said, listen, we need some help down here. And one of the things that we need help on is with education. And so he actually makes an appeal to a number of folk outside of the South to say, come down to Alabama and help build schools that can provide quality education for people. And so he draws upon these folk who come down, white teachers in part, to help start the Calhoun Colored School. And it's not just about education. I have to add this to this story. One of the things that the Calhoun School does is that they start a land trust called the Calhoun Land Trust. Because one of the things that African Americans faced was not only unequal education, but also they were caught in this cycle of debt slavery, if you will, sharecropping, where they could not get land of their own. And land in these agrarian societies was so critical. And so they start this land trust. So they pair quality education, a decent education, with the acquisition of land for African Americans so they can become economically independent.
How did they do that?
Well, one, they call upon African Americans who were sharecroppers at the time, literally to pool their money and resources to buy land cooperatively. But then they also appeal outside of the South, not only to African Americans, but drawing upon church networks like the Methodist Church to fundraise and collect money so that they could buy land collectively and then break it up
and sell it to African Americans in smaller parcels so that they can become independent landowners. So it's not only a story of white allies coming south to help African Americans gain a quality education that the public schools that the state was refusing to offer them, and this becomes a private school, but also about economic independence, which speaks to this broader agenda of freedom rights for African Americans as a whole.
You know, Lauren, just talking about that and talking about the land rights and that kind of thing, you see the parallels with the United Farm Workers, with the migrant workers, with the Native Americans who've been pushed all over the place. Heaven only knows, you know, what where they're at. Now they're on reservations and that kind of a thing that they own. But it just how much of that factored into the – was that a strong parallel in the movements?
Absolutely. The importance of land ownership, I think, is a freedom right, as Hassan mentioned, that really – crossed racial and ethnic boundaries. And in fact, a woman from SNCC, Maria Varela, she traveled to Delano and made a film of the farm workers and brought it back to the rural South. And it was, and she would show African-American sharecroppers this film of what how Mexican-American farm workers were dealing with this issue of working the land. And she said that it often brought tears to the viewer's eyes to recognize these parallel land struggles. And she ends up, after working in Mississippi and Alabama, moves to New Mexico to help Native Americans and Mexican Americans start farming cooperatives, for which she wins a MacArthur Genius Grant. And it's because of her experience in the South and seeing firsthand the importance of land and of land ownership in particular in the freedom struggle that she's able to then go to New Mexico and do that.
We don't have time for any more calls, but I did want to thank, you know, Emily, I wanted to ask you how critical at this point in the historiological work on the civil rights movement are those local stories?
Oh, I think they're fundamental. I mean, if you listen to the themes that have been coming up in the conversation that Hassan and Lauren have just brought up in terms of, or been talking about in terms of these freedom rights, in terms of what the movement was about, in terms of who was involved in the movement, in terms of what the opposition looked like, in terms of what was successful and what remains to be done, and, you know, sort of a clear sense of where we are today, I think that if you look at local movements collectively, as Hassan mentioned, place is important. They're not going to be the same in rural Mississippi or in Lowndes County as they are in Milwaukee or as they were in Montgomery or some of the sort of better known, more visible places. So you have to look at both particular local places and what the themes are that you see across the board. But you really see a different kind of movement, a very different kind of movement than you do in the kind of top-down there's both the sort of top-down history and then the mythologies that grow out of it. And so I think if you don't have local studies in the picture, it's very easy to see it as a movement about integration and voting rights, as a movement that's nonviolent, as a movement that's led by King and that has been entirely successful, particularly with the election of President Barack Obama. And then that obscures totally the continuing issues of economic inequality, of quality education, and the sort of that we see.
Emily Crosby, Associate Professor of History at the State University of New York in Geneseo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Crosby is the author of A Little Taste of Freedom, The Black Freedom Struggle in Claiborne County, Mississippi. Also with us, Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's an Ohio State University Associate Professor of African American History. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Hassan is author of Bloody Lowndes, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. And also Lauren Areza, she's an Assistant Professor of History at Denison University. Thanks for coming into the studio today.
Thank you.
Lauren is working on a book, For Freedom of Other Men, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the United Farm Workers. Thanks for joining us today on All Sides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus. And streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.